WAER Sports proudly presents the Ostrom Avenue Podcast.
At the 30, at the 20, cuts towards the middle, and Nykeem Johnson takes it home for a Syracuse touchdown.
Orange going quick. Bounce pass, Jimmy Boeheim, baseline drive, and jam!
Going through all the good.
To the midline, it's bobbled, and Syracuse wins!
A winding shot by Trimboli, 10 yards out, shoots, he scores!
And all the bad.
Syracuse, bowl ineligible for the third straight year.
They made it into the NCAA tournament as a number 11 seed, but it is over as Houston moves on to the Elite Eight.
And now, here are your hosts, Johnny Gadamowitz and Ethan Frank.
Time for another edition of the Ostrom Avenue Podcast. Today, Johnny Gadamowitz and Jordan Leonard with you. Ethan will join us a little bit later on when we talk with Emily Liker, a little SU football, for our interview. But Jordan, first time it's just the two of us on the pod. How you doing today?
I'm doing good. You know, Syracuse almost came back to win it last night, but fell a little bit short. But it's going to be a fun one with you, Johnny.
An 84-82 loss. Syracuse falls to Pitt, a game that they trailed by as much as 20, down by 8 at the break. Pitt really just opened up the second half with an absolute surge. The Orange stormed back, but it was too little, too late. I was there for the broadcast on the call last night for WAER, and Jordan, it hit a point where I fully bought into the fact that Syracuse might come back and win this thing. Joe Girard hits that three to make it a one-point game, and then the final two possessions of the basketball game just absolutely botched. I mean, you cannot turn the ball over in a situation like that. I think I'm willing to blame it entirely on Jim Boeheim. I don't understand how that first play of those last two was not drawn up for Joe Girard. It was Judah. You inbound the ball to him, looking the way of Jesse Edwards down low. Federico, the Pitt big man, had done his job locking down Edwards and Munir Hima for most of the night. That's not the look I would have went. Jordan, I don't know if you disagree, but for me, it really comes down to lack of execution and lack of what you draw up down the home stretch on those final two plays.
No, I absolutely agree. When Federico fouled out with about 5 minutes left, that's really when the turning point came. Syracuse was down 15. But when you have a chance to tie the game on that last possession with Judah Mintz, Jesse Edwards had four fouls for a while in the second half, only at 8 points. Why is Syracuse drawing up a play for Jesse Edwards, especially if he didn't have it going that game? Joe Girard just hit an amazing three-pointer. I was watching the game. I was like, no, no, no. And then, of course, you know, the ball goes in, so it's
one
a good
those.
Shot. It was one of those. Judah Mintz ended up with 24, Joe with 16. I don't know why you're not drawing up a play for either of those guys. They had it going. Even Judah, two threes, Joe, 3 of 8. I mean, they had it going all game. Why? And then if you're Judah Mintz, why are you forcing it into Jesse Edwards too? He telegraphed that pass for about 5 seconds before it even happened. Blake Hinson had the easy steal. And then when you have to play the foul game, it's always hard to come back from there.
So Syracuse's 5-game winning streak comes to a very abrupt end. And I mentioned it on the broadcast last night as well. You know, it's an alarming loss in that this is a Pittsburgh team picked to finish 14th out of 15th in the preseason poll. And I know preseason, you can only take so much stock into that, but there are much tougher games ahead than a December home game against the Pittsburgh Panthers. And for Syracuse to fall flat in the way they did, it's really disheartening. I mean, only 6 3-pointers on the night. For much of the night, the Orange had only 2 threes made and made a couple down the home stretch to make things interesting, but they were out-rebounded on the glass, -9 on the glass, and there were a lot of issues. Jim Boeheim addressing those issues post-game, pinning a lot of it onto effort, saying he hasn't seen a lack of effort like that ever from particularly his forwards, the likes of Chris Bell, Benny Williams, who combined for just one total rebound. I think for me, Jordan, the big thing is, like, what's the end game with this team? Like, what is best case scenario? I see a team that is just way too streaky, way too hot and cold, way too reliant on Joe Girard III to make shots. And if he doesn't make shots, well, then you've got not a whole lot to work with, because Williams is not nearly developed into the scorer that I think Orange fans hoped and thought he would. And sure, even if you're getting a consistent double-double out of Jesse Edwards, at some point, offense has to come from somewhere else. The freshmen, while we've seen from bright spots, Malik Brown, Kwadi, or Copeland in particular last night, it's just not enough on this team to get quality ACC wins.
Yeah, I don't know what the best case scenario is. I guess right now it would be just to be on the bubble towards the end of the season. I think Pittsburgh's a better team than everybody thinks. They have really good guards and Blake Hinson, Nelly Cummings, Greg Elliott. They can shoot the ball. But I mean, the forwards this season have been terrible. Benny Williams and Chris Bell, only 13 minutes last night. To think that they start the game and then only play 13 minutes overall is just to show how much Jim Boeheim is not liking his forward play at the moment. I thought Malik Brown played good in stretches. He got the most minutes pretty much he's played all season. He scored 6 and got 9 rebounds, but he's not putting anything on the offensive end in terms of shooting. Quadir Copeland did good. He got that 4-point play that I was confused on why he even pulled up to take the shot, because he hadn't really taken any threes all season, but he made it. So he played good, but I mean, it's really just the Joe, Jesse, and Judah show, and then hopefully another fourth or fifth scoring option comes up once in a while. But Syracuse, if they have any chance of winning these ACC games, they can't start slow. They've started slow pretty much every game since the month of December started. They won every game up until then because they've had big second halves. But in ACC play, you have to start strong. You can't rely on coming back in the second half to win games against ACC opponents.
Yeah, and Pitt definitely did not start slow last night. And a big reason why, Nelly Cummings, now 2 straight years for Cummings with 6 threes when coming to the Dome last year, of course, with Colgate, this year with Pittsburgh. And Boeheim was asked about him after the game, saying, you know, what makes him so difficult? What makes him so good? Jim's response, he made shots. Fine. I mean, I guess, yeah, he made shots. But, like, what's your answer to that? So what, every time another team is making shots, you're going to lose the game? Like, it goes back to the argument of just not enough offense. It's one thing if your defense isn't up to speed and teams are recognizing they need to shoot to beat the zone and they're doing that effectively, but you got to have an answer. You've got to have some sort of counter, some sort of plan B for what the heck is going to happen if Girard has an off night. And that's not even to say that Girard had a crazy off night last night. I mean, by no stretch was it his best game of the year, finished with 16 on 5 of 11 from the field. But I just found that funny of Jim's response of, well, we made shots. Okay, so like I said before, what? Every time teams make shots, you're down for the count? No, there's got to be a little more, you know, get back into it. That's got to light a fire under this Syracuse offense to manufacture points somehow, some way. And Jordan, just not a lot of areas where offensive checkboxes are being made in that department.
What I don't understand about the defense is why they're allowing teams to shoot all these three-pointers. I mean, Pitt went off 13 threes overall, a lot of them coming in the first half, 8 of them coming in the first half. If you have a shot blocker like Jesse Edwards underneath, he had 6 blocks in the game and he dealt with foul trouble most of the second half. That just shows you how much of a ring protector he is down low. If you have that presence down low, why not force them to drive the ball and contest with that instead of take open threes early in the game? I mean, every single three-pointer was open, and if it wasn't, Joe Girard was covering them, and it's an easy shot over the short Joe Girard. It really doesn't make sense. I think they really need to think about their defensive philosophy. I think the zone can work. I think they just have to make it to their strengths, which is down low with the rim protector Jesse Edwards, force teams to drive the ball and go through him.
Should be very interesting to see how that zone changes, if at all, depending on the matchup, too. I mean, you look at the past 2 games, Cornell attempted, what, I think it was 48 threes back last week, and Pitt follows that up with attempting 32 of their own. Not nearly as much, of course, but a number that stands out. So teams have certainly done their homework, done the scouting report on the Orange defense, and recognizing that, hey, look, you want to come up here and put up points, that's something that's definitely an option, but what you need to do is you need to make your shots. And Cornell did, well, Cornell did not do that, I should say, despite taking all those looks. Pitt took a similar amount of looks, and it was a different narrative, and it, of course, led to a different result. So I think a lot of Orange fans were really kind of hoping for that 7-plus game win streak. You talk about Pitt, Boston College coming up, and then a trip to Louisville right after New Year, and Louisville is just in shambles, of course. But now it begs an interesting question of, where do you go from here? You've got about 11 days in between Pitt and Boston College, spanning from December 20th to New Year's Eve with no basketball game. I asked Jim yesterday after the game, you know, what's some of the upside, what's the downside, pros and cons, if you will, of having that long of a layoff? And he said, well, you know, it's nice, everybody gets to go home, We'll come back. We'll get a good 5 to 6 days of practice in before you take on the Eagles. Jordan, I think for me, it's important that you don't let things crumble from here, right? You've got two extremely winnable ACC games out there in the near future. Go home, enjoy the holiday, you know, get in that family time, what have you. But then you got to go out there and take care of business of Boston College. And when you hit the road to the KFC Yum Center and play Louisville on January 3rd as well.
Yeah, I mean, Syracuse needs to hit the film room and figure out what to do on defense. The offense will come. I'm not too concerned about that. When Joe Girard doesn't hit shots, it's going to be hard to win. But in general, the offense will come. The defense is where it starts, because if you can get stops on the defensive end, you can pretty much win any game in college basketball. And we were talking about the best case scenario. I mean, if Syracuse can't beat Boston College or Louisville, Louisville just lost to Lipscomb yesterday at home. So if they can't beat either of those teams, the best case scenario is probably bubble of NIT play. So you got to hit the film room. You got to figure out what's going wrong, because these two next two games, you don't want to say a must win in December and January. But if you look ahead to that January schedule, these two games are definitely must wins.
And of course, that next game coming on New Year's Eve at 2 p.m. against Boston College, WAER's got you covered with McClurg team countdown to tip off at 1:30. We'll switch things over to the gridiron now, because believe it or not, Dino Babers' team is not yet done with their 2022 slate. We've got the Pinstripe Bowl coming up, Syracuse and Minnesota, all sorts of news on the football front of things. We caught up with Emily Leiker of Syracuse.com to help us break down all things Hughes football related, and Ethan joins us as well. We hope you enjoy it. Moving right along here on the Ostrom Avenue podcast, Johnny Gadamowitz, Ethan Frank, Jordan Leonard with you as always. Today we're joined by Emily Leiker of Syracuse.com, covering Syracuse football all season long. Emily, how's it going today?
I'm well. How are you guys?
Doing good. Doing good. Thanks so much for coming on. It's been a little while here on the podcast since we've really done a deep dive into the SU football realm of things. Obviously, a lot happening as the Cues get themselves ready for Minnesota in the Pinstripe Bowl. We'll talk all sorts of things surrounding the program throughout the next, you know, 20, 30 minutes, whatever it is. But I guess where I kind of want to start, Emily, is, you know, as someone like yourself who's really been covering this team boots on the ground since camp now, here we are after this roller coaster of a regular season with a bowl game that Syracuse gets, whatever the vibe is going into it. In your eyes, what's sort of the overall significance and the importance of the fact that Syracuse, well, did go get this bowl game and is indeed playing in the Pinstripe Bowl against Minnesota coming up on December 29th?
Yeah, you know, when I made my preseason prediction, I predicted them to finish 6-6. And so middle of the season, that looked like that might be completely wrong and they might end up going like 11-2 or something. But obviously it shook out to them finishing 7-5, which was pretty close. I felt pretty proud that I was that accurate in my first year on the beat. But I don't think it was really a surprise to anyone that they managed to make it here finally. I mean, you look at kind of who was on the team this year and the team's biggest leaders like Michael Jones, and you got Andre Schmidt returning and Garrett Williams, all these people, like these guys had been here for 3 years, 4 years, some even 5 years, or you're looking at Devon Cooper. He's been in college football for 7 years, been here for two, but you got a really experienced team that's been building towards this one goal. Like coming into the season, everyone was talking about the bowl game, the players, that was like the one goal they had. If you asked them about individual goals, it was mostly like, I don't have an individual goal. I just want us to get to the bowl game. So that was so clearly the overarching storyline of this season. And just with the experience that they had, the new coaching staff coming in, I mean, obviously at that point back in camp, you were looking at brand new coordinator, offensive coordinator, Robert Anai, quarterbacks coach, Jason Beck, some other people in there like Bob Ligaszewski, Michael Johnson, they were in really good position. And so then those first six games looked great. I don't think anyone expected it to go like that. That was definitely a shock to me. And I think most of Syracuse Nation, the players will say that that wasn't a surprise, but I would have to assume they're exaggerating a little bit there. So yeah, I mean, I think in the grand scheme of things, the season shook out approximately how people were expecting. If you're just looking at numbers and the record and like what type of bowl they ended up in, it's just when you kind of get into the nitty gritty of how they got there, things are a little bit more interesting.
Yeah, for me, it's the process, not the results. I think if you asked anybody at the beginning of the season, Syracuse finishes 7-5. Okay, you know, that's great. This is a team that had finished under 500 3 years in a row and didn't go to a bowl game. But when you look at how they got to 7-5, when you're 4-5, 6-0, then the expectations start to be raised higher than they probably should have been. And I think that's what causes the disappointment of fans and people around the country. So would you say this last portion of the season was a disappointment, or was it really what Syracuse should have been all along? People just had their expectations raised from that hot start.
I think it's definitely the latter. I mean, we spent a lot of the first half of the season warning people essentially that the back half of the schedule was going to be more difficult. I mean, obviously there were some teams in there that for a while it looked like that might not be the case. Like Florida State wasn't great at the beginning of the season when they came to Syracuse. Obviously they destroyed them, but Florida State, Wake Forest, those were some teams that kind of middle of the season, it was like, okay, well maybe those won't be as difficult of games as we originally thought they were going to be for Syracuse. And then that really didn't end up being the case. But I mean, the back half of the season was always supposed to be the more difficult part. So I think if the first half of the season hadn't gone as well as it had, there would have been less outrage over the fact that there was 5 straight losses to end the year. And the Boston College win was not as smooth as it probably should have been, but that was still an expected one and they did pull it out. So I think the back half of the season really didn't go that much differently than most people thought it was going to. But because those expectations, like you said, were heightened by the first 6 games of the season, it made this huge, big storyline out of them having a 5-game skid.
Looking ahead to the bowl game, there's been a lot of turnover over the last couple of days. Robert Arnott to NC State, Jason Beck now the offensive coordinator. How does the team kind of adjust to that? They have an extended time to prepare, but how do they adjust to the new voices calling plays going into the bowl game?
Yeah, you know, I think on the offensive side of things, it's not going to change a lot. I mean, obviously, Robert Arnott and Jason Beck were tied at the hip for like 13 seasons. They know each other. Beck knows Anai's system. I would doubt that he's going to start implementing a bunch of changes between now and the bowl game. I mean, they only have 15 practices that they get to have between the end of the regular season and the bowl appearance. And I honestly don't think they've had very many of those practices yet. So this will really be the first week that they're diving into some of that stuff. So I wouldn't expect on the offensive side for there to be a bunch of changes now. I think Jason Beck was clearly the right choice for a new offensive coordinator. I mean, this is a guy who's been waiting to get this type of promotion, I think, and keeping stability in there when you're also returning your quarterback, Garrett Schrader, who saw immense improvement under Beck. I think that's just the correct formula there. I mean, if we want to get into the defensive side as well, I mean, the Rocky Long hiring, I think we'll see how it unfolds. I think on its like surface level, it makes sense just because he's the godfather of the 3-3-5 and you're keeping that system in place here that has been so successful for Syracuse. I think in terms of his age and the different positions he's been in recent years and where he's been, like there's maybe some questions there as to like what his contract looks like and stuff like that, just because I don't know. It's just an interesting thing to think about. But I think both of the coordinator roles make sense, and I don't expect there to be a lot of differences in how Syracuse is approaching its game planning for Minnesota now that they've swapped those guys.
In the context of Anai and Tony White specifically, I mean, with the way that news sort of trickled down with both coming in one day, and it was, oh my goodness, where are we going from here? Did it feel like those two moves from your vantage point, you know, were sort of bound to happen, long time coming type decisions? Or, I mean, I guess you could say Tony White, you know, his name has been thrown around for a while now as far as other positions, but more focusing in on Anai specifically, was that something that caught you off guard, or did it not really come as much of a surprise?
Anai was definitely a surprise, especially too, just because it happened at 10 p.m. on a Thursday night. I was definitely like about to log off all technology for the night and then barely got a tweet notification and a text from a friend that was like, oh God, you're really going through the ringer today on your beat, aren't you? And I was like, oh Jesus. So yeah, I mean, he was definitely a surprise. I mean, it's not often that you see coordinators in and out just for 1 year. And it's not like he had an unsuccessful year here. Were there problems? Were there issues at different points? Yes, definitely. I mean, we all saw how Sean Tucker was used in some of those games in the middle of the season. That was definitely an issue. But now that I've like kind of dug into that a little bit more and more stuff has come out, I definitely think it seems like it was more of just a family thing for him. He's got family down in North Carolina. His son coaches at a school out there. He's an older guy. He might be heading towards retirement. I mean, he had some other tough things happen. I mean, he was very close to the three Virginia players that were killed. So this has been a strenuous year for him. So I haven't had the chance to talk to him or anyone super close to him, but now that I've read more, it's not as surprising. In the moment, it was surprising, yes.
So I guess when you think about coordinator turnover, then your mind immediately shifts to both who is replacing them and what are their players going to do. And Syracuse has seen some interesting moves with its players. I think at this point, I would have expected more defensive players to have announced their intentions to potentially leave and hit the portal. Obviously, you have Garrett Williams going to the draft. You've seen both Deuce Chestnut and Jihad Carter go to the portal, but then you also have Syracuse bringing a couple guys in. So how much turnover do you potentially see, specifically on the defense, where there might be more of an incentive to leave and follow Tony White because of what he's built, rather than an offense that, you know, is more or less staying in the same hands?
Yeah, you know, I think we're probably in a lull period now. Like, I don't see that many more players hitting the transfer portal in the next week and a half before the bowl game. I think the guys that are still here want to play in this game at this point, and they're not going to leave. That said, after the bowl game is done, the transfer portal is still open until January 18th or 19th. I think there will be more people in the portal then. It kind of just all depends, I think, on what these guys think of Rocky Long, what his coaching style is. I mean, obviously he's running the same system, but these guys really liked Tony White. Anytime Tony White got brought up in conversation, players were like, oh yeah, he's a future head coach. We love him. He's great. He would let guys script plays for the team. Like, I talked to multiple players who were like, oh yeah, I wrote up a play and we ran it in practice, and then we're going to run it in a game one time. Like, Tony White was a player's coach. And I think a lot of that comes from him being a former player himself and a younger guy. And so he's definitely going to have a different style from Rocky Long. And I'm curious to see what players think about that. We'll hopefully get to talk to some of the players within the next week. It kind of depends with Christmas and then the bowl coming up. I'm not sure exactly what that'll look like, but I think right now we've probably seen the last, knock on wood, of the transfer portal until the bowl game. And then after, there might be some more names to spring up. But I definitely was surprised there wasn't as much as a mass exodus on defense. I kind of tweeted right after Tony White left. I was like, oh, we're going to see some players leave. And then we only saw like two or three. Jeremiah Wilson came back out of the portal. So that was definitely surprising. That doesn't happen often. But yeah, it's not over yet, but I think it's probably slowed down for the time being.
For the offensive side, when it comes to the portal, obviously hiring Jason Beck, promoting him from quarterback's coach to offensive coordinator helps with the continuity. But do you see any kind of turnover there with the transfer portal? Maybe some offensive players want to play in the bowl game and then maybe enter it afterwards?
You know, it's hard to gauge. I mean, like, a lot of the guys on offense that are starters are like getting consistent playing time. I mean, it's not like defense, where I feel like there is a lot more turnover this year, like even in the season with injuries and stuff. And so maybe you had some guys that came in and got some playing time and then now aren't going to get it again because players are coming back from injuries. I think position groups on offense that are always kind of rife for more transfers is definitely just like wide receivers and the offensive line. Most of those guys, though, I would expect to be ones who don't play as often. Like, I mean, Anthony Quealy, Dom Foster, Courtney Jackson were already in the portal. Courtney Jackson, obviously a starter, but didn't see as much action this year as he has in previous years. So I can't say like any of the starters I could see going into the portal at this point. I guess two names that people seem to be worried about, but I haven't heard anything to indicate that there should be worry, is Aronde Gadsden and then like possibly LaQuinn Allen. I mean, Allen made a little bit more of his name for himself at the end of the season. He's now obviously going to be the starter, so there's not really incentive there to leave. But Aronde Gadsden is one of those where people seem to be very worried he's going to be lured away by like an NIL deal or something like that. And I still don't think that happens as much as a lot of these older college football fans like to think it happens. And so I don't think he will be leaving anytime soon. I guess that's always on the table until the portal closes, but I don't see there being a lot of transfers on the offensive side of the ball at this point.
All right, so we've mentioned some faces that could be leaving, some that could be staying, a couple of new faces as well. Let's hit on someone that we haven't really talked about too much yet. That's Dino Babers. Where are you at right now as far as evaluating Dino's performance this year as the head coach of this football team and what sort of the future could have in store for him at the helm?
I mean, Dino had a fine season. I mean, 7-5, that's improvement over what they've been the past two seasons. It's one of his better records here. There was no reason to fire him as this season ended. Like, and I don't think that was really ever truly on the table unless something had gone catastrophically wrong, which I don't know. I guess you could argue that 5-game skid is a little catastrophic, but like I said, it was kind of expected as well. So I think Dino was fine. And the thing about like college football coaching is so much of it is like contracts and stuff like that too. Like he has a $10 million buyout that was reported by, I think, Pete Thamel earlier this year. And so that's a lot of money for a school like Syracuse to spend. And then you have to bring in a new coach and spend even more money on that new coach. So I just don't think Dino being fired was ever really on the table as much as people wanted it potentially to be or thought it was. I mean, back in the summer, one of the first things that I did on the beat was a press conference with John Wildhack. And he was like, Dino's not on the hot seat. The most recent talk we had with Wildhack was our columnist Brent Axe did a Q&A with him a couple weeks ago. And he was like, if Dino keeps on improving, we're not going to get rid of him. As far as we know, his contract runs through 2024. I'll be curious to see what qualifies as improvement enough to get him like a contract extension, because if they go 7-5 again next year, I don't see them extending him past 2024. If they go 10-2 next year or get closer to that 2018 record, then maybe they talk about extending him again, especially if he can maintain this coaching staff and keep more guys here. I mean, sure, they've lost 9 players this season, but only 4 of them have been starters, and 9 players is still a lot lower than a lot of those programs you're seeing out there. So I think as much as everyone wants to constantly light the fire under Dino Babers' seat, I think he is fine for right now. And I think he is doing a good enough job for him to be justifiably kept around for another season.
And it seems like he's pretty busy recruiting right now as well. He's been doing a lot. You mentioned only 15 practices between the end of the season and the bowl game. So it seems like Dino is taking advantage of that on the recruiting trail. You look at the guys he's brought in, he's bringing in these players, you know, former, you know, pretty high recruits, guys from Nebraska, Notre Dame, Alabama. Obviously, if you're transferring from those schools, something did not go right for you to be leaving one of the top programs in the country, but there's still a raw talent there that maybe Syracuse can tap into. When you look at recruiting, and specifically in this 2023 class, the big name that I know you've been covering is Lenora Sellers and trying to keep him for signing day. How realistic is it that Syracuse keeps him, and what else do you see Syracuse potentially doing before signing day? Because they've been racking up, you know, some of these big names, like I mentioned, but also some smaller JUCO prospects as well.
Yeah, you know, Lenoris, I think, is the big topic of the week, and really the only player people are keeping their ears and eyes open for on Wednesday, signing that letter of intent. The last I talked to him, he seemed pretty set still on signing with Syracuse, and I've talked to his coach, and his coach said that he was set on signing here. He's supposed to be an early enrollee. That doesn't feel like something you'd commit to doing if you thought you were maybe going to choose a different school. Albeit, I have heard from people down at South Carolina that they are going after him hard. I heard from one of my friends who covers the team down there that they're still pursuing him even this week, which is crazy to even think about. But I'm still leaning probably like 70-30 that he'll sign with SU. I honestly think if we're looking at the grand scheme of things for him, I think it would be more likely that he comes here, plays a year, and then transfers somewhere else than just declares somewhere else, like, off the bat. So that's kind of where I'm at on the Norris Sellers. You look at the rest of the class, and there's, like, good names in there. I think David Clement, who's the tight end from Christian Brothers Academy out in Albany, he was supposed to be one of the top players in New York this season and then had an ACL tear that he had to recover from. I'm curious to see kind of how he shapes up as a player this spring. He's going to be an early enrollee. There's a lot of good names in here, just not any like eye-popping names. As for the transfers, like you mentioned, that's where it gets a little bit more interesting. Really intrigued by the D lineman that transferred from Alabama. He has a pretty interesting story. He didn't play last year, I believe, because he medically redshirted. So that's a little interesting. I haven't been able to get a hold of him to talk with him more about it, but I think he could be a big contributor early on if they are willing to kind of work a little rehab, it sounds like. And then the two corners, I mean, those were the biggest pickups I think Syracuse has had this offseason, especially in light of the Deuce Chestnut news. So I'm excited to see what Gould and Bellamy kind of bring to the table and what kind of competition that creates between them and then Jeremiah Wilson, who chose to return as well.
So one way to bolster some recruiting is to get a bowl game win. Looking into the matchup between Syracuse and Minnesota, one thing Syracuse didn't do towards the end of the year because of some injuries was stop the run, and Minnesota runs the ball pretty well. They're second in the Big Ten and they have the leading rusher in the Big Ten. How do you think overall Syracuse kind of matches up to Minnesota?
Yeah, you know, like, I think these are two pretty evenly matched teams minus Muhammad Ibrahim. Like, he is one of the best rushers in the nation, and like you said, Syracuse just did not perform well against the run in the back half of the season. A lot of that was due to injuries, and I would expect that after 21-30 days off, these players are feeling a little bit better. Obviously, you're still going to be missing some key players. Terry Lockett, Denis Jacquez Jr. still out on the defensive line. Garrett Williams obviously isn't playing, so there's going to be some stuff there on the defensive end, but overall, this team should be more well-rested, so you would hope that would make things better with the run defense. I think that's Minnesota's biggest weapon by far. They also have a pretty solid defense, so it will be interesting to see, now that Tucker's not playing, whether Syracuse commits kind of just all out to going through the air, which has worked well for them, but also the receiving core, minus Aronde Gadsden, hasn't been, like, thrilling this season, so I'll be curious to see whether they lean really heavily into that, especially with Beck as the new OC, or if they do try to let LaQuinn Allen kind of cook a little bit, let him pop off some runs. We'll see. He's a pretty versatile player. So I think it'll be a pretty even matchup. There is still time, I guess, for Ibrahim to opt out. I haven't seen that he's doing that, but that's still kind of something that could unfold this week. And that would be, I think, a big game changer for the Pinstripe Bowl if that did happen.
I know we're still very far out from it here, Emily, but getting closer as time moves on here. But any, could we perhaps trouble you for any sort of prediction? I mean, there's no switch in the cards, but.
I usually don't do my predictions until like day before, so I can't say I've thought too hard about it yet.
That's fine. We don't want to put you on the spot.
I don't know that I have a number, but there will be one out there from me at some point in the next couple weeks.
Well, we'll certainly keep our eyes and ears out for it. That's Emily Liker of Syracuse.com breaking down all things Cuse football related for us here on the Ostrom Avenue podcast. Emily, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Emily for taking the time. Now, for what it's worth, recorded that with Emily back on Monday. So, of course, that was pre-Matthew Bergeron announcing that he'll forego the bowl game and is indeed headed to the NFL draft. Jordan, positive news for Bergeron in that, you know, I think that's something that was known for quite a while by Orange fans, really established himself as one of the premier offensive tackles in the ACC, and Syracuse fans are lucky to have him these past few years. But in terms of the micro level of that, you look ahead to Minnesota, and SU will be without one of their best pass protectors and run blockers at that when they take on the Gophers come the 29th.
Yeah, that's definitely a big hit. Whenever you lose an all-ACC left tackle, especially in a bowl game, it's definitely going to be a big hit. But it'll be interesting to see how the Orange react to that. Obviously, some younger guys are going to get some playing time. LaQuinn Allen's going to be the starting running back. And then you get some of the younger offensive linemen that get a chance to kind of cement themselves possibly for next year. So it'll be interesting. It'll be a cold one in New York. So it'll be interesting to see how Syracuse plays outside the dome in the cold weather.
Of course, no Sean Tucker either, who also declared for the draft earlier in the week. Short of that weird, don't really want to call it a turnover period too much because, heck, there's still a bowl game to play. The season far from over, and I'm sure if you ask Dino Babers, he's treating this game very importantly and wants to go grab that win against Minnesota. An 8-4 Minnesota team that went just 5-4 in the Big Ten, but an opportunity for the Orange to end their season on a high note, but so many Syracuse fans looking ahead to next year at this point as well. National Signing Day is among us. We expect Lenora Sellers to have some sort of official signing come later in the week. I think Friday is the day that has been thrown around a lot. We'll see, of course, if that comes to fruition. And you heard Emily mention it earlier, but Jordan, can you just imagine with all this Orange program has endured and dealt with over the past couple of weeks as far as losing offensive coordinators, losing defensive coordinators, players opting out of the bowl game, declaring for the NFL draft. Now, all of a sudden, if your supposed prized possession next QB of the future decides to flip his commitment elsewhere, that would just go from bad to worse for Syracuse fans.
That would be probably worst case scenario. Lenora Sellers has been kind of the keynote to the class pretty much since he committed to Syracuse, has been attached to Jason Beck, which is the only reason why I'm kind of confident and hopefully that he'll sign because Jason Beck's now the offensive coordinator. But that would be a huge hit to a class that's middle of the pack, you know, bottom half of the ACC, but you get that quarterback that can come in and develop in Lenora Sellers. He's kind of a dual threat where he can run, and he's been lighting up down in South Carolina. So hopefully he'll hold off the South Carolina Gamecocks recruiters a little bit longer until he hopefully signs on Friday.
South Carolina, most certainly the team whose name has been tossed around the most when it comes to any other universities or programs that might be in the mix for the highly touted four-star quarterback. So Syracuse basketball, Syracuse football, both still in full swing. Dino Babers' crew not done yet. An opportunity to end the season on a high note, and it comes December 29th against Minnesota from Yankee Stadium in the Pinstripe Bowl. That one that, of course, Syracuse fans are looking forward to. It's a 2 p.m. kickoff from Yankee Stadium. That's our next broadcast on the original home of the Orange. We've hit a little bit of a low in the action around Christmas time. Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas to anyone who celebrates, of course, as we wish you a happy holidays and a happy new year from the original home of the Orange. But be sure to tune in December 29th, again, a 2 p.m. kick against Minnesota, and then SU Men's Hoops, Jim Boeheim and company back in action 2 days after that on New Year's Eve, a game that was initially slated in the calendar for either December 30th or 31st. They do indeed settle on the 31st. The Cuse in action hosting Boston College, and that game will tip off at 2 p.m., a 1:30 McClurg team countdown to tip off. That'll do it for this edition of the Ostrom Avenue podcast with Jordan Leonard. I'm Johnny Gadamowitz. And for our co-host, Ethan Frank, as well, a big thanks to Emily Liker for hopping on also. We'll catch you next week. Be sure to leave us a like, follow on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast. We really appreciate all that interaction on Twitter. You can also follow us at Ostrom Avenue Pod over there as well. But with Jordan, I'm Johnny saying so long. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next week.